Hi, listeners. I'm Brian, and this is The World as We See It, the podcast that follows me on my travels to gain some perspective from the interesting people I meet on the way.
Andy Aronson here. Today we are talking with Tim from Ottawa. Hi, Tim. How are you?
I'm doing great. The tail end of a long day, so hopefully I've got some intellectual capacity left for this.
I think we win either way. Either you do, and we have intellectually stimulating conversation, or you don't, and I bet that will be fun in and of itself.
Yeah, there's the amusement factor. It is win-win.
So I have already heard a squeak or two.
Yeah, I am fending off a puppy with one hand, which is going to further distract me. After a long day, I came home to my wife saying, "It's your dog. You deal with her."
And what did your wife say?
Pardon?
What did your wife say?
She said, "Oh, take the dog."
Oh, I'm sorry. She said to you, "It's your dog. Deal with her."
Oh, exactly. Yeah.
She said that to me when I got home. Do you want to tell us about the puppy?
Yeah, sure. Her name is Laika, after the Russian dog that was sent up in Sputnik 2.
Yeah.
She is much cuter and much less dead.
Oh, dear. Well, I'm glad she is less dead.
Yeah, and little puggle that's about 6 months old, and therefore takes a lot of energy. But I shall try not to let her interfere with my already limited mental capabilities.
Tell me what a puggle is. I've heard the term, but I don't know.
It's a pug beagle mix, so a little bit of a wrinkly face, a little bit of a stout body, some big floppy ears, and big black eyes.
And how old is she?
6 months. And like I said, when she bothers to hold still long enough, quite adorable. And when she gets annoying, quite annoying.
Now, I'm not really familiar with various dog breeds. How much is she like pug? How much is she like, did you say beagles?
Beagle, yeah, half pug, half beagle, and she's a very excellent mix, like an even spread of qualities, so nothing jumps out at you as being scabbed on from another dog, in effect.
I was actually thinking about her personality.
Oh, and her personality, she is pure energy at this point. Much like the Vorlons on Babylon 5, she is a little shell containing boundless energy.
Okay. I have not actually seen Babylon 5 more than one or two episodes.
Well, I've spoiled for you what a Vorlon is.
That's okay, I'll forget. It's one of the advantages of having a bad memory.
One of many, I would assume.
So, tell us how you met Brian.
Meeting Brian is probably the second weirdest story from the last year of how I met someone. He is, as you know, and I assume your listeners know, doing his North America-wide road trip. And while he was in Ottawa, he, as I mentioned in my podcast, Why You're Wrong, pretty frequently, I sell cars in Ottawa. It's in a so far vain effort to drum up business. But when Brian was in town, he sent my podcast partner an email asking for confirmation which dealership I was at and just dropped in to surprise me. It is one of the weirder work experiences, but quite pleasant to know that there's fans out there and that I'm worth a check mark on a trip across the continent.
Nice. So tell us about your blog. I don't know a whole lot about what you do or what your blog is about.
It's a podcast called Why You're Wrong.
Podcast. My apologies.
That's all right. The web address is www.whyyourewrongpodcast.com, all one word. With my partner, Jesse Dibka, we talk about sort of the very soft side of skeptical. Try and keep it interesting and light without getting to be a hardcore skeptical podcast about current events, science, psychology, history, trying to be sort of the mythbusters to the hardcore skeptoid out there. Not that I don't like a good skeptical podcast too.
Okay. And did you say something about it having something to do with your work as well?
Well, I try to. Jesse does the editing on our podcast, and I try and throw in at least two shameless plugs for my work selling cars in every episode, but many of them get edited out. So I've got this little thing where I'd like to make money, and I live in hope that one of my listeners that's local will come in when they need a vehicle, but it hasn't happened yet. In fact, I got really excited when Brian came in and said he was a podcast listener, because I was thinking, oh my God, it's finally paid off. I've got someone coming in to buy a car and ask for the podcast discount, but no such luck. It was just a fan call. And once I got over my disappointment, quite a pleasant one.
So there's a podcast discount then?
Well, yeah, I haven't had an opportunity to decide what it would be yet, but I assure I assure my listeners that there would be one, yeah.
Okay. Well, I'm perfectly happy to let you do a plug, and we've done a fair amount of plug already. Is there anything else people should know if they're...
I suppose I should mention the actual name of the dealership. I'm at Hyundai in the east end of Ottawa. Should any of your listeners be in my general area?
Well, last I heard, we have 15 subscribers, so it's possible.
Well, that's where it starts, you know. I still remember when we started our podcast, I would make frequent remarks to our fan in the singular until we started getting emails saying, okay, there's more than one of us. You can cut it out now.
That's great. So how did you start podcasting? What led to that?
Oh, Jesse and I have worked together off and on for years. We met at a terribly crappy but highly entertaining job that we both shared at one point. And the podcast is basically a slightly more organized version of the conversations we tend to have when we're on our own. We're both sort of people of wide-ranging interests, and so our conversations tend to bounce around through various topics we find interesting. And it occurred to us that there might be listeners out there demented enough to also find them interesting. And that's the genesis of it.
And you know, despite the fact that I'm actually doing a podcast, I know very little about launching a podcast. So when you started yours, was there anything in particular you did to get the word out that you were doing this, or is it all completely word of mouth, or what?
Pretty much completely word of mouth. You know, we used social media, so we put on our created a Facebook page, put it on there, and I think that's probably the greatest way to gradually build a podcast. You know, people initially who you know directly through your friend list will start listening, and those likes will show up, and then it'll spread through their friends. I mean, the ripple effect can take off fairly quickly. Not that we have, you know, legions of listeners, but there's I don't know the numbers. Jesse knows them better than I do, but there's a fairly solid amount of listeners there, and it spread all over the world. We get reader comments from Poland, Australia. Australian physicists, mostly, for some reason. There seems to be a lot of overlap between physics and Australia, but
well, it's interesting, and I'm not surprised to hear that physicists are interested in debunking things.
Yes, and I'm actually more interested in the emails we get disagreeing with us than the ones praising us, because I find there's more fun to be had with those, and you get the whole range of everyone from. Well, I'm not going to swear on your podcast, but complete Looney Tunes sort of can't be talked to. And some people who quite frequently make excellent points, either something we missed, factually wrong, or just another way of looking at the issue that is worth considering.
Okay. And does Jesse work with you still?
No, Jesse and I, career-wise, gone separate ways. He's a photographer in the Ottawa area. And our overlap was I was for a couple of years his manager at a swimming pool store. We worked in the parts department there together. Mm-hmm. His job interview came at a particularly short staff time. A mutual friend of ours already worked there and said he had a friend who might be looking for a job. And I phoned him and asked if he could start tomorrow and threatened to kill his dog if he didn't show up.
And you hadn't met before.
No, we hadn't met before. This was all over the phone. I ran a fairly freewheeling, loose ship in those days.
How long ago are we talking about?
Oh, let's see. We're talking about 2004, 2005.
Let's see. So a little while ago.
Yeah, a little while ago. And he followed me to a local Ottawa bookstore after that, where I was, where I also worked. And then our careers spread different directions. Unlike me, he actually completed university. Although how that led him to photography is sort of anyone's guess.
How did you get into the auto dealership?
Well, I working in pool parts, I got into pool sales, and then I decided I'd like to sell something that I enjoyed more and where people already know they need it. You know, people need cars, so that part of your job is done. It's just a question of which car and when. When you're selling a pool, you have to first convince them that they need it, and then that they need yours, and then that they need it now. So there's a step skip there.
Right. Yeah, it's always a lot more fun to sell something you actually are, you know, happy to be selling. Though perhaps I'm jumping to unfair conclusion.
No, I actually love the I sell Hyundais, and they're not to turn this into a total plug. They're fantastic cars. But 6 years ago, I probably wouldn't have looked at one. 5 years ago, I bought one from the dealership I now work at, and as of last year, I sell them. So there's definitely, I'm clearly a biased individual, but I had a bias for this dealership and these cars before I started working there.
Okay. Do you consider yourself a car guy?
No, not at all.
Okay.
I'm pretty much a standard consumer with cars. I like to know, sit me behind the wheel and I'll tell you whether or not I enjoy the drive. And I like playing with buttons and gadgets, mm-hmm. but I'm definitely not someone who can gap a spark plug or even tell you what gapping a spark plug means or if that's a real thing.
Well, you've even got me a beat by one because I'm not sure I'd heard the phrase before. So.
Well, I may have just made it up. Like I said, I'm really a nuts and bolts guy.
Okay.
It sounds familiar, but I find I'm better suited to selling. It turns out more people are like me than out there than know how to take an engine apart themselves. So I'm not over technical because I don't know how to be.
Something I found in my own work and what I do is computers and helping people get like websites and databases set up and this sort of thing. And often, you know, they're faced, I think, with a very similar problem to somebody who goes into a car dealership or goes to an auto mechanic and just knows so little about what's going on underneath the hood that they just, that there's no way for them to make a decision about what they're being told in terms of whether it's a reasonable amount of work or a reasonable cost and these sort of things.
Well,
I think it's an interesting question to figure out. How do you help somebody like that feel assured that you really are on their side and you want to, you know, help them do the best?
It's very difficult. And I think there's a lot of psychology, both officially studied and sort of unofficial, sort of street psychology that you pick up as you go. But there's a world of difference in any business that deals with helping people with things they don't understand, be it sales or technical support, where there are people out there who give any such field a bad name. And there's people out there who are honestly trying to help people make the best decision. And I hope I fall more into that latter category.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But I think we're all, when it comes to computers, I've got mine open in front of me here, but I'm certainly at the mercy of experts when it comes to it. So much of modern technology is just magic in a box that we depend on the particular wizards who know it to tell us what to do.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, I'm going to jump to another topic. Because you mentioned earlier that Brian was the second weirdest person you met this year. Is that right?
I didn't say Brian was the second weirdest person. I said it was the second weirdest meeting I had this year.
I didn't mean to say it incorrectly there.
The weirdest one, for sheer unlikeliness, was actually a bit less than a year ago. I started talking to a couple customers, engaged couple, and we started chit-chatting. And while I was going to get keys to show them a car, I come back and the guy of the couple says, "Is your last name Wilson?" I go, "Yeah." "Did you go to this school?" I go, "Yeah." It turns out we'd gone to grade 5 together for one year. Well, most grade 5s are 1 year, but we'd gone to elementary school together for 1 year. After that, I'd left the country. Before that, I was at a different school. He was at a different school. And he remembered this 20 years later. And in the small world of a reasonably large city, we'd run back into each other.
That's so weird. How did he remember you?
I'm very surprised, too, because I didn't consider myself that memorable, although I did tend to get in trouble a lot. But I also did nearly die at his birthday party that year. So I guess that contributed to it. And we were actually quite good friends that year, but had completely been out of contact for 2 decades. And it's actually been a great experience, much like meeting Brian has led to this interview. Meeting this old friend has brought me back in touch after this 2-decade gap. So my wife and I went to his wedding and are still keeping in touch with him and his wife now.
Oh, that's fantastic. How big is Ottawa?
The greater Ottawa area, like a lot of cities, there's the city proper and the little suburbs that are semi-independent, but the greater urban area is about 1 million people, give or take. So by no means a super city, but a good size urban sprawl.
Yeah, that's actually a very similar size to Indianapolis. Do you find that there are definite divides in sort of what type of people live in sort of which directions, like north, south, east, or west, or something like that?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, for one thing, you don't have French people.
In Indianapolis?
Yeah.
Not a whole lot that I know of, no.
Well, Ottawa is on the border with Quebec. So part of the Ottawa urban center is on one side of the river Ottawa, on the other side, the Quebecois city of Gatineau. And there's a number of bridges across, and like a lot of places, like, what is it, Minneapolis, St. Paul, I think, in the States, its expansion has formed one large urban center.
Okay.
So we've got a cultural divide of a lot more French-speaking people on one side of the river and English-speaking people on the other. And then, yeah, there's definite gradations of, socioeconomic divides in different neighborhoods.
Sure. So the French, non-French, I totally understand, and I'm not surprised by it. I don't know that much about Canada, but I've certainly heard about French-speaking people and English-speaking people. Are there other sort of cultural divides within Canada or that you find in Ottawa? Like in the U.S., there's a north-south divide, for instance?
There's definitely some Canadian equivalents. If you go into the prairies, so north of your heartland, you get into our conservative belt. So our cowboy country tends to be the home of the stronghold of our conservative party and the home of the more conservative wing of it.
Okay.
A lot of it's actually very analogous to the States. The West Coast tends to be fairly relatively liberal and hippie-ish, for lack of a better term. I'm stereotyping grossly here, but just in general terms. And our East Coast has a lot more similarities to the Northeast Coast of the United States, so the New England, Maine, that area.
Mm-hmm. And are there places where people from different areas tended to settle? Like, do you find a lot of Irish in some particular city or anything like that?
There's definitely strong links in various places. In a lot of the Maritimes, so our West Coast, there's a strong, the first wave of immigrants was heavily Scottish.
Yeah.
There were, although it's spread around a lot of our prairies were settled by Slavic communities. So there's a lot more Kowalskis and Kavalchuks and so on, traditionally in the prairies. There's of course much more Chinese and Asian immigration right on the West Coast. A lot of it has, evened out over time.
Just curious, just trying to get a sense of kind of what's going on in Canada and whether there's, similar things to like the Boston kind of, I don't know what to call it, but there's definitely a culture in Boston that's not exactly the same as the rest of the states. Well, you could say the same thing for New Orleans as another real obvious example.
I think every country is going to have, strong character associations with particular regions. I think to an American outsider, I think Canada's might be more subtle than what you're used to.
Mm-hmm.
Except for the extremes of the Maritimes, in particular Newfoundland, there's a lot more consistency in the accents, mm-hmm. A lot less wide a swing than I think what you get in the States.
Yeah, maybe so. I just went to the Irish Festival here in Indianapolis, and there was a group performing who were from somewhere in the Maritimes. I couldn't tell you exactly where. I don't know if it was, you know, Newfoundland or Nova Scotia or what. But their musical history was clearly very similar to what I'd heard from musicians from Ireland and Scotland, that sort of thing.
Well, you get into the Maritimes, bagpipes play a big role in a lot of ceremonies, but there's a strong Scottish connection. I mean, part of my family goes back to a lot of Scotsmen. I actually got married in a kilt because of that side of my family.
Oh, cool. Did you enjoy that?
Yeah, it was great. I'm getting a lot of noise here. I look damn good in a kilt.
Okay. I think that we are coming up on time to maybe take a little bit of a break. So we will get some noise sorted out, and then we'll come back and hear more about kilts and looking damn good in them.
She'll fill three pages of mine. We'll write about writers who can't seem to write the reveals outside the lines. Stuck in the silence of acres of snow, struggling to structure the book.
Welcome back, everybody. We are still talking with Tim in Ottawa, and he has just let Laika enjoy the outdoors to make it a little bit easier on both of them.
This also means I'll have no excuses for any distraction or misspeaking, so I've got to watch myself.
That's right, and if we hear squeaking, we know it's not Laika anymore.
Well, I've got to chew on something.
All right, so tell us how wonderful you look in a kilt.
I look fantastic in a kilt. I've got a picture of my wife in a wedding dress and me in a kilt on my desk at work, and I always tell people this, and they think I'm joking. All my self-esteem is from the knees down. I have fantastic calves.
Fantastic calves, really?
Oh, they're dynamite. Well-defined. You bounce a quarter off, get five nickels back. Problem is that north of the knees, I'm a train wreck, but under the knees, I look great. So the kilt is the perfect outfit for me.
And does it extend all the way down to, like, you know, the ankles and the feet, or is this really just a calf-focused phenomenon?
It's primarily a calf thing. I mean, my feet are okay. It's tough to have fat feet, but it's really the calves where the action is.
All right. I'm reasonably comfortable with my manhood, but I do think we should probably move on from this particular topic. But I'm not quite sure where to go next. What else should I ask you about? Should we talk about travel or food or something else?
Oh, we can definitely talk about travel. I've been very lucky in my life to have had a pretty international sampler, for lack of a better word. When I was younger, I lived in Tokyo for 3 years. I went to England and joined the Royal Navy in the early 2000s. And both of those gave me an opportunity to see a fair amount of the world.
Mm-hmm. Did you say you went to, I may have missed it. Did you say you went to Tokyo?
Yeah, from 10 to 13, my family lived in Tokyo. So I had a very interesting experience there, which was probably one of the more defining things in my life. Certainly in terms of specific events.
Do you want to tell us about it?
Yeah, it's the sort of experience that you wish everyone could have, but then you sound like a snob for saying it, which isn't my intention.
Okay.
Because I know that there's nothing wrong with not having that sort of international experience, but it's certainly, you go to a country where, first of all, as a white English-speaking guy in Canada, going to a country where I am a highly visible minority is a whole different perspective.
Ah, yes.
And so I was young enough to not realize the full extent of it, but you get experiences like people bad-mouthing you because they think you can't understand what they're saying, difficulties getting a taxi to stop for you, people pretending they can't see you on the subway so they can try and bump you into a wall, which doesn't really work out on a husky 13-year-old who's already 6 feet.
Yeah.
But there's definitely a perspective on that of seeing, for those of us who aren't a classical minority in our homelands, to get that experience of being on the other side of the percentages game in terms of who is and isn't a minority, it's a very different perspective.
Mm. Yeah. And you said you were there from 10 to 13, so I imagine not only with everything you learn, but also just with your own ability to understand things, the difference between 10 and 13 is reasonably large. So
yeah, it's a point where you do a whole lot of developing and growing up. It was a very interesting spot to be doing that. You're getting on the cusp of young adulthood, getting old enough that you start thinking that you can act like an adult, even though you can't.
Yes. Wow. So
I should sorry clarify. I mean, I chose the example of sort of being on the other end of some racism. There's certainly a lot of great stuff that I experienced in Japan. There's a lot of laudable features in the culture. It's very disciplined. There's it's overly formalized, but there's a certain courtesy and politeness that pervades the culture. And there's I'm not going to say exotic, but there's a different worldview. So I don't want to leave the impression that it was 3 years of hell as being a tortured minority, because that's not the case at all.
Right. That's a good point. I think you brought out a very interesting point about changing from being the majority to the minority, but that doesn't mean that was everything that happened to you while you were there.
Exactly. I just don't want to get angry letters from Japanese people.
Right, from one of our 15 subscribers.
Well, you know,
you never know.
It's going to take off and spread, and people love the back catalog.
So what part of Japan were you in, just out of curiosity? Not that I know that many parts.
Right in Tokyo.
Oh, okay.
Which was a huge culture shock. I actually grew up just outside of Ottawa until that point. It's a little more suburban now. It was a farming town that was just starting to get the beginnings of suburban sprawl reaching it. Mm-hmm. So there was the general store, the one restaurant, the hockey rink, one of everything. Mm-hmm. Everything was a bike ride away. And then I moved to a city that has the entire population of Canada in an area the size of the Ottawa Valley. It's a heck of a culture shock.
So if you can remember, think back to what you were expecting before you got to Tokyo, and then how was it different from that?
I honestly am not sure what I was expecting. I think this is a little bit weird, but one of the things I expected going over was that I would have more Japanese friends. Whereas, and I think part of it is a young kid not wanting to stretch too much outside of his comfort zone. But I had American, Canadian, Australian, British friends more because there was a shared cultural language that was almost too much work to get across, even though the actual language of all the Japanese kids in my school, they all spoke English.
What kind of school did you go to?
I went to an international school, so basically a private school for foreign kids.
Did you go to ASIJ?
No, I went to Nishimachi.
Okay.
ASIJ is decent school. The other big one, there's sort of a rung of exclusivity. There's ASIJ, then a rung up from that is St. Mary's, and then Nishimachi is the smallest. Okay. And I'm biased in favor of my old alma mater, so I think it was the best school. Very non-traditional. It was started by distant relatives of Admiral Yamamoto, the famous Japanese commander in the attack on Pearl Harbor.
Yeah.
It was started to give kids a broader cultural view. Compared to most international schools in Japan, it had about half the students were actually ethnic Japanese. Mm-hmm. Primarily Japanese children who'd spent too long living abroad and couldn't reintegrate into the highly conformist Japanese culture.
Mm.
Their parents would put them in an international school just to avoid the difficulties of sort of reintegrating after 3 years in America.
Interesting. What was it, a all-ages school?
That ran from kindergarten up to grade 9. And I left after grade 8, which was very frustrating because the grade 8s planned the graduation dance for the grade 9. So I got to do all the work and never got my own benefit.
And what was it like coming back to Canada then?
Well, it was I think in some ways it was more of a culture shock than going away. you go to a foreign country, even at 10 years old, you expect that there's going to be differences.
Mm-hmm.
And you don't realize while you're away how much you've changed.
Right.
So it's a little bit weird to come back. One of the subtlest and strangest things that hit me for years and still occasionally comes up is confusing people who don't look anything alike.
I'm sorry? I don't understand.
I'll explain. There's technical terms for it, but basically in sort of Western European ethnicities, when you're looking for features to distinguish people, to tell the difference between you and Brian and me, mm-hmm. you look for height, weight, gross facial structure, eye color, hair color, mm-hmm. because these things all vary between individuals.
Mm-hmm.
In Asian countries, they don't all look the same, but those standard features that Europeans are trained to look for
mm-hmm.
are all the same. So you look for different facial markers, you know, cheekbone structure, jaw shape, teeth shape, things that we don't use in our regular sort of checklist of this is how I identify people.
Okay.
So in coming back to high school here, there were two guys who I always got confused because they looked the same to me, even though there was 4 inches different in their height and they had different hair and eye color.
Huh.
I'd become used to their facial shape, though, for those other markers that I was used to looking at were very similar. And despite
that's
the
fascinating.
Fact, it's things like that that you don't consider how those small adaptations affect you.
Yeah, that's really fascinating. So I actually lived overseas in 10th through 12th grade in Hong Kong.
Oh, very similar.
Yeah.
One of my very good friends from Tokyo left and then spent the rest of his teen years in Hong Kong.
But that's why I've heard of ASIJ, for instance.
Festival coming over from Tokyo?
Well, I had a friend who he spent his senior year at ASIJ. So I had known him in Hong Kong and then he went to Japan and that's the school he was at.
Sort of the reverse of, so how, have I been talking out of my hindquarters here, or is this stuff sort of resonating with you?
No, it's, I think your experiences have been different than mine, but not obviously wrong or anything like that. But the reason I brought this up was to say that just coming back over the summer one year, I remember looking at American money and going, how do you tell any of this apart from each other? It's all the same color. Because it was all green. This is just an example of how the kind of reverse, culture shock of returning.
Yeah, and the stuff that, like I said, you haven't realized how much it seeped into you.
Yeah. I don't think we got the same level of discrimination in Hong Kong, or I was obtuse to it.
I don't think so either. Based on comparing notes with my friend who was there, It was a little bit different. I'm sure it carried with it its own different bits of weirdness.
You're talking about sort of the difficulty of returning Japanese fitting into the school system there. And I think that the Japanese culture for their school system is very, very different than Hong Kong. And I think it's indicative of how Japan is actually quite different from Hong Kong culturally. Like, you know, I think of Canada and the United States, for all that we have differences, as being much similar to each other than, say, Japanese and Chinese.
Absolutely. I think Japan is, its physical isolation has led to an enormous amount of social separation from its closest neighbors. That water barrier is quite distinct. And the school system is famously conformist. I remember when we would go, on an annual ski trip at my school, and I honestly believe that ski groups were determined for Japanese schools based on uniformity of appearance, or physical appearance, because you would see groups of identical, even to people who are used to, sorry, it sounds crass, but telling Japanese people apart.
Uh-huh.
The groups of identical looking guys dressed in identical colors, ranging from falls down getting off the ski lift to swooping effortlessly over the hills. And it seems very, as a microcosm, it seems very in keeping that the groups would be divided up more on that uniformity of appearance than the skill that they actually have.
Wow, that's interesting. It reminds me of a lighter topic related to Japan and skiing, which is that I actually went to Japan once, and it was for the purpose of going skiing. And we went to a place, and I'm blanking on the name of it, but it was famous for only having three Western, well, at least amongst those of us going from our high school who were used to Western toilets, for only having three Western-style toilets in the entire town. So one of the hazing rituals was that the people who'd been there before would only tell their friends where the toilets were, and otherwise you had to go use the local stuff.
They had those squat toilets in Hong Kong too, didn't they?
Sure, but not in my apartment.
Ah, yes, well. <quite a detail. laughs>
So I got to experience a Japanese shower, which was just baffling to me. I walked in and there's like a bowl and a hose. And I was like, what do I do with these things? So I eventually found some way to wash myself, but it was just like, all right, got to figure something out.
Well, you have to learn by doing, right? Some stuff soaks into you, though. It's 17 years since I've been back, and I still look at having a bath as one of the great recreational activities of everyday life.
It is a lovely way to take oneself out of the craziness of the world, isn't it?
Exactly. And yeah, very separate from, it's one of the few things I absorbed that stayed with me, the very sharp distinction between the cleaning process and the actual bathing process.
Mm. All right. So we're probably just going to talk a few more minutes, and we haven't touched on the fact that you were in the Royal Navy yet. You want to tell us what led for you to be in the Royal Navy?
Yes. Silliness, basically. A desire to do something different. I have a strong interest in military history and the military. There's a lot of military service in my family. My grandfather in the Second World War in the Royal Canadian Navy. My father and two of his brothers in the Canadian Army. My cousin currently in the Canadian Army, who was injured mercifully, minimally in Afghanistan a bit more than a year ago. So lots of family connections. So it was always something that interested me. And when it came time to join up after I dropped out of university and didn't have anything else to do, mm-hmm. just sort of random research led me to the discovery that because Queen Elizabeth is the Queen of Canada and of the United Kingdom, mm-hmm. I was allowed to go over and join the Royal Navy.
So here's where my ignorance plays in. I didn't realize that when you said the Royal Navy, you meant the British Royal Navy.
Yes, there's the Royal Navy without adjective is the British Royal Navy. At the time, Canada's Navy was called the Canadian Forces Maritime Command. Don't get me started. But yeah, I actually went to the United Kingdom and joined their Navy because Canada is still a part of the Commonwealth of Nations. And my restrictions were that I could not do anything nuclear, so I couldn't go on a submarine, which did not break my heart conceptually.
Yeah.
And that there was a trade called communicator that I wasn't allowed to do, which is not the guy who operates a radio. It's the person who operates radio and speaks flawless Chinese, Russian, and Arabic.
Okay. Well, what's your Japanese?
My Japanese was not that good.
Okay. All right. And how did you enjoy being in the Royal Navy?
I actually had a great time for a lot of it. I left because I had a lot of family stuff had come up at home, and I was actually only in for about 6 months. I did my training and was set to go to sea when I realized that I come from a very close family, and I realized that it was too far away with all this stuff going on, and there would always be stuff going on, and that fundamentally I couldn't stay for what would have obligated me for a 9-year commitment.
So I
really enjoyed it. It really was something, after going to Japan, probably one of the second most definitive experiences of my life. And it's definitely, it's another thing that I would say without trying to sound conceited, everyone should be in the military at some point because you certainly learn a lot about where your limits do and don't lie.
Interesting.
There's a mentality that you'll do what you're told even if you think you can't do it. Climb that wall. I can't climb that wall. It's 80 feet high and it's got 6 handholds. But I've been told to do it, so up I go.
I can totally see that. I can see that being really useful for me and probably everyone to to get a better handle on what you really can or can't do. That's what I'm hearing you saying.
Exactly. There's a lot of stuff, discipline. If you don't know how to iron a shirt, you'll learn. But fundamentally, the greatest strength I found from it was that you learn to break through your limits because you have to.
So aside from the things that you learn by being in the military yourself, do you think that, this is really going off on a tangent, do you think that it should be compulsory, because doing some sort of service for your country sort of teaches you the importance of doing service for your country, that kind of thing?
No, I'm not a big fan of compulsory service, because I think it carries a lot of complications with it.
Mm-hmm.
One of them is a much greater political reluctance to actually use the military. If you have an all-volunteer force, it's still very touchy to risk your military getting shot at.
Uh-huh.
But there's a general understanding that these people signed up and they knew damn well what they were getting into. If you talk to people in the military, I think you find that they tend to have a different view of casualties in war than people who don't have any contact with the military. I think it's odd, but the people who are most at risk of actually being killed or wounded, uh-huh, are more accepting of it than people who have no exposure to it, because they know that's part of the risk and they're prepared to take that risk.
Yeah. Interesting.
Yeah. But it's one thing when you're volunteering for that risk, to be forcibly signed up for it, would really limit the freedom of a military to use its troops.
What do you feel about the fact that for socioeconomic reasons, there's a bias towards some groups to go into the military versus other groups? Or it's possible that Canada doesn't have that same bias that I think the U.S. has.
It's present, but it's nowhere near as pronounced as in the United States. Part of it is that the Canadian military is even per capita smaller. Mm-hmm. So there can be a little more selectiveness to recruiting. But it's one of those things. On the one hand, it can be a great equalizer. You know, a military experience for people who have no other opportunities can be a way to learn a trade, to get out of their geographical limitations, you know, to get out of the one part of town where they probably spend the rest of their life. You know, by joining up, they learn how to do something, they see the world, they often end up taking root somewhere else. So it can be a great leveler.
Mm-hmm.
It's uncomfortable in, I think, what you're getting at, the idea that it's poor people and black kids who are ending up on the front lines a lot of the time.
Right, because you made what I thought was a really good point, that the people who volunteer for an army don't understand the risks, and therefore there's sort of, you can kind of use the army when you need to without having quite as much backlash. But if some people are going into the army not because they understand the risks, but because they don't have any other choice, then it's tantamount to compulsory service.
And I can't speak for the American military, but I do believe that you cannot end up going through basic military training without a very firm idea that you might die. You do enough dangerous stuff that it is implanted in you that this is a very serious obligation and you're taking a very serious risk. Now, obviously people who are in more dire straits are going to be more prone to seeing that risk is worthwhile.
Right.
But there's a huge history of that. In the Napoleonic Wars, a massive chunk of the British Army was recruited from Ireland because it was a time of famine in Ireland and it was the only way out for a lot of them. So it's always been the case that people who are in the most dire straits are going to see the most benefit joining up. I would say the bigger problem is, and I really don't want to get on a soapbox, especially as a non-American, but the bigger problem would potentially be that socioeconomic groups that are in these dire straits may have a higher correlation with ethnicity or other factors like that.
So the issue isn't necessarily that people in the low economic ladder are going into that, but that there's a correlation on people in the low economic ladder being from certain cultural or racial groups.
Exactly. And I guess I'm saying there's always going to be people on the bottom of the rung or who get in dire straits. There's fishing towns where the fish dry up. There's mining towns that go under there's manufacturing towns where the factory closes. So, you know, there's always going to be people who get pushed in that direction. It's part of a vibrant economy that's renewing itself. Mm-hmm. So I don't have a problem with the fact that some people are going to be a little more desperate. I don't like it, but it's a fact of life. Mm-hmm. But if those desperate people are disproportionately black, for example, because that is sort of the concern and has been since the Vietnam War in the United States, mm-hmm. that's the Absolutely. Bigger problem.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. Very good. Look, we have gotten to weighty, important issues.
Sort of a roundabout way, but I'll take any route to something fun to talk about.
I think that you have very successfully mastered the temptation to play with the squeaky toy and instead be able to show off your ability to carry on conversations. Well done, sir.
Excellent. Well, as soon as I stop talking, I'm going to dig into that squeaky toy.
And with that, we will call it an excellent interview, and my thanks for participating.
Thank you very much. It's been a great pleasure, actually.
All right. One final plug for your show and for your dealership.
So I sell cars at Pathway Hyundai in Ottawa's East End, and I also sell ideas on Why You're Wrong, which you can find at whyyourewrongpodcast.com.
All right. Thanks a lot, Tim.
That's all for this week, listeners. Comments? Questions? You can send those to brian@annbetter.org or leave a comment in the show notes at annbetter.org. I'd like to thank our guest Tim for joining us this week. Information on his podcast, Why You're Wrong, can be found at whyyourewrongpodcast.com. I'd also like to thank Marion Call for the use of our theme song, Perilous Road, from her album Something Fierce. You can find it, along with the rest of her work, at marioncall.com. Finally, I'd like to thank you for listening.
Drive like you're drunk, you can blame it on the rats in the room.